Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
When I left Madison, Wisconsin, it was dark, cold, and snowing. When I arrived at Santa Barbara, it was bright, sunny, and warm. The thought did occur to me that only someone who had suffered 28 years of Wisconsin winter could even come up with a topic, home is elsewhere. To offer this topic at Santa Barbara cannot help but be unconvincing. But let me give the old college try. All animals move out of their home base when, for one reason or another, conditions deteriorate, or when they are threatened by enemies. They move because they're pushed. Only humans move because they're not only pushed, but pulled by images of something better elsewhere. Much of human history is one of migration. On the other hand, much more of it is people staying put in one place, generation after generation. Even when they see better living elsewhere, they're content to remain where they are and enjoy what they have, then venture into the unknown. Humans are conservative. They have a fondness for the familiar, for home, for security over adventure. And yet, how do we know that even the most sedentary people do not dream of elsewhere? In what follows, I'll recapture what I take to be a fact, the centrality of home to humans, and then suggest, nonetheless, the tug of an envisaged elsewhere, even if no action follows. Home and its Germanic, Gothic, Old Nordic, and Lithuanian cognates all connote abode, dwelling, village, a safe place. The Chinese 家 or 家乡, a non-Indo-European language, carries a similar material and emotional load of meaning. By comparison, the French chez soi is out of line in that it emphasizes a personal relationship. To be chez soi is to be, as it were, en famille. Lacking in that word is the feel of material weight. Another French word for home, maison, takes one perhaps a tack too far in the other direction in that it invokes too much of architecture. Yet this may be just a modern misreading, for maison's Latin root, manere, means to remain, to dwell. Home, to give it a slightly fuller definition, is the locale of human warmth and material sustenance, moral property, and spiritual comfort. So understood, which people best meet the criteria? Ethnographic evidence points to the hunter-gatherers. Their way of life is so intimately and gratifyingly interwoven with land and its resources that the possibility of moving elsewhere or adopting another people's way of life never seems to have crossed their minds. Should they be forced to move or adopt, they suffer severe demoralization from which they seldom fully recover. Numerous cases can be cited. Outstandingly, the Mabuti forest dwellers of the Congo, the Kangan of Brazil, the San Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, and the Australian Aborigines. What about peasant farmers? Aren't they also deeply attached to home, and soil. City people certainly think so. To them, peasants tilling the earth seem to fuse with it. They are, as it were, children of the earth. And what they do year after year has the feel of a natural cycle. Yet I wonder, is their attachment quite so deep? How does it compare with that of hunter-gatherers? The Dao De Jing, a Chinese classic that dates back to the 3rd century BC, raises a doubt, for it has a passage that urges villagers to stay put and not be tempted to go elsewhere. Such urging would, of course, not be necessary if loyalty to place can be taken for granted. Chapter 80 of Dao De Jing says, and I quote, "Let the people refrain from migrating to distant places. Let them be content with their food and clothing, satisfied with their homes and simple ways of living. Though their neighbors are so close that they are within sight of each other and can hear their cocks crow and their dogs bark, let the two peoples have nothing to do with one another." Whatever the significance of this admonition, it remains perfectly true that old-time farmers are rooted, as modern men and women are not. Mobility, like individualism, are features of modern life, the two being closely linked. An individual dissatisfied with his community's settled ways moves out to take advantage of opportunities elsewhere. Americans are well known for both their individualism and their mobility. They change homes so readily that by the time they are late middle-aged, they may have lived in several. What then can home mean to them? Has it become merely a temporary abode, a way station, or even just an investment? In contrast to home's traditional sentiment-laden meanings. Home, the real living home, evokes memories and images unlike those of any other place. What might these be? For middle-class Europeans and Americans, they plausibly include such common places as the porch that overlooks a tree-lined street, the afternoon light that streams in through a corner window, the comforting food odors of the kitchen, the sound of the lawn mower in summer, and of the snow plow in winter, and certain ordinary doings of life, greeting the mailman, scolding the dog, barbecuing the backyard, that, though prosaic, can nevertheless be etched in memory. The most vivid hauntings are, however, likely to be those of childhood and of childhood's home. Why? Well, consider the following facts. Home is never more a nurturing shelter than to the very young who are well aware of their vulnerability. Children's engagement with home has a directness and immediacy that grown-ups more prone to critical appraisal have lost. Children's senses, undulled by habit, are keen. Moreover, they like to touch. They know the world through tactile intimacies. They live close to the ground, the source of many odors, and odors like touch stir the emotions at a more primitive level than do hearing and sight. And last but not least, children have no pressing responsibilities that divert them from the full sensory experience. John Updike, a keen observer of middle-class America, captures these points in a short story. He tells of a child who woke up with a sore throat and stayed home from school. He called imperiously to his mother, who carried up to him his breakfast of fresh orange juice, seedy from his squeezing, the toast warm from its toasting and cut into strips. the Rice Krispies, the blue cream pitcher, the sugar. The child sunk into the fever swollen mountains and valleys of the blankets where books and crayons kept losing themselves. Outside, grown-ups attended to their duties. No duty was laid on the child, however, other than to live, to stay safe and get well, to do that large something called nothing. The house in all its ridges attended to him, settling, ticking, clucking in its stillness. Grown-ups, too, know something of this caring aspect of home, as well as home's ample sensory stimuli that, for all their fleeting existence, add up as the days, months, and years go by. The result is the rich and subtle ambience that is home's unique signature. Since this ambience is hard to put into words, it is rarely acknowledged at a conscious level. Also adding up as time passes and contributing to home's difference from other places are routines that create stolid comforts. The word routine suggests the humdrum and the inconsequential. However, unlike the routines of workplace and office, those of home are not inconsequential, for they are dictated by the cyclical requirements of biological life. Rootedness converts place into home, but how long does it take to do so? Not generations, as one might think, but more like decades or even years. If this sounds implausible, it is because we fail to distinguish between being rooted in place and having a sense of place. Rootedness is, or can be, an objective measure. Archaeological and historical research shows that some people have lived in the same place for centuries. Sense of place is, by contrast, a subjective measure, having less to do with the length of habitation than with the people's affinity for the substance and aura of a place. People who are objectively rooted may nevertheless have only a limited grasp of time span, how far it extends into the past and the future. Hunter-gatherers, for example, tell stories of their ancestors, but these reach only a generational tool before they merge with mythic founders and heroes. Their view of the natural environment also lacks temporal depth. The Mabuti, a group of hunter-gatherers in the Congo forest, know intimately the plants and animals upon which they depend for their livelihood, yet show little knowledge of their stages of maturation. They are unaware that the aquatic larva they eat turn into mosquitoes, or that caterpillars turn into butterflies. Some rooted people have created high culture, with writing as one of its proudest adornments. Such people might be expected to value their past and to have recorded it in writing. Not necessarily so, however, as the case of India shows. Rather than record the good times and bad times, the successes and failures of the past, as the Chinese have done, Indians chose to bolster their sense of collective self with a rich body of myths and legends. Museums are another means to memorialize ancestral accomplishments. Significantly, neither China nor India thought of building them until the influence of the West was felt. America, on the other hand, showcased its past even before it had much past to showcase. Boston established a historical society in 1791. New York did so in 1804. Others soon followed. In each instance, the society's purpose was to collect and preserve documents that told a more or less flattering story. But not only written documents were preserved, also preserved and put on display were material artifacts such as old furniture, tools, and all sorts of bric-a-brac. Such humble collections might constitute the core of a future museum. By the 1960s, there were some 2,500 museums in the United States, as compared with only 274 museums known to exist on the Indian subcontinent. The United States is a young country that constantly reaches out to the future. Old neighborhoods are demolished to make room for high-rises and shopping malls. Such future orientation means that American people lack a proper sense of place, which requires, among other things, an appreciation of the past. While this is true, it is also true that an excess of appreciation can work against a sense of place. America is settled with this excess, it being a country that officially designates certain buildings and neighborhoods as historic landmarks to be protected against not only demolition but change, and it is famed for its unabashed boosterism of its towns and cities. Of course, many small towns in heartland America do not advertise themselves, are not self-conscious about their past, or boastful of their future. Time in such places is not directional, but cyclical, as nature's course is cyclical. Or it is the thick present, that is to say, it can seem to stand still like those drowsy Sundays that never end. The people who live in small rural towns feel rooted, and they may be said to have a deep sense of place, even though that sense is not given articulation. Helen Sandmeyer comes close to depicting the mood of such a place. This is what she says of her own hometown, Xenia, in Ohio. It was home the same day by day, year after year. The town has no high moment of beauty and perfection to lay an obligation on us to preserve it as a museum. It encourages no glamorous illusion that life once was wholly fair. It is a background that makes no demands on its children. It does not sustain in them any extravagant hope. In these streets, under these roofs, they are free to dream their dreams in peace. They are also free to forget them when they must, and to accept instead the humdrum daily life of the generations of mankind, the same life that has given the scene that weight and density which even children busy with their sleds have apprehended. Now, compare Sandmeyer's Xenia with the Heimat as idealized in an Austrian almanac of the year 1953. An Austrian's past is undoubtedly deeper and more colorful than that of an Ohio town, yet I maintain that its sense of rootedness and of place is weakened rather than strengthened by an overblown rhetoric of appreciation. The almanac declares of Heimat that it is, I quote, first of all, the Mother Earth that gulps down God's clouds, sun, and storm, so that together they prepare the bread and the wine that rest on our table and give us strength to lead the good life. Heimat is landscape. Heimat is the landscape we have experienced. That means one that has been fought over, menaced, filled with history of families, towns, and villages. Our Heimat is the Heimat of knights and heroes of battles and victories, of legends and fairy tales, and so on and so on. A fundamental appeal of house and home, and for that matter, of any solid material object, is its projection of stability and permanence. We humans need both, since we creatures of mood and flesh are neither. We die and quickly exit the world. Material objects, by contrast, endure, and they can be passed on to posterity. The chair I'm sitting in should be good for another 50 years, writes a reporter in the New Yorker magazine. The typewriter should clatter into the 21st century. This solid glass paperweight could be darn near eternal. People who may not be born yet should come by my house and snatch them up as the wonderful bargains they will be. That's why I took good care of them, to extend their usefulness beyond the unimaginable day when I'm no longer here. The big orbits of prominent people referred to legacies they left behind. And maybe they did, and maybe they didn't. I'm definitely going to leave a black Underwood upright in very good condition, cheap, and who knows what that could lead to. In 1983, when the article was written, it was still possible to believe that an Underwood upright could be a living legacy. Only a couple of years later, the word processor displaced it, and the typewriter's further life, if it had any, would be in an antique shop. Home itself is not as enduring as it seems. Not that it falls apart, rather its human dwellers do. As humans grow old, objects start to withdraw or turn hostile. The table that was a source of pride becomes a sharp-edged threat in the dark, and the stairway that promised access becomes a barrier. As for human relationships, home is customarily remembered as a cove of mutual support and comfort, forgetting that it can also be a prison in which feelings that stew in confined space turn into hatred and despair. Life's tragic comic dramas occur mostly in the home. Between them stretch dull periods of inconsequentiality. On the bright side, home is where people rest and recoup. It is where they sleep. Now, sleep would seem to be an unqualified good, and yet it is not without ambivalence. In dreamless sleep, people are at one with the world, a state that is much desired but rarely achieved while awake. The desire to merge is, however, a sort of death wish. To be alive is to be separate. It is to break out of home, home's cocoon, for the chillier, more invigorating air outside. Living home is undertaken, for the most part, out of necessity. A longing to return follows and is suffered in silence. Occasionally, however, it finds utterance in lamentation, poetry, or song. Thus, an Aranda warrior in Australia sang, "The fatal combat is done. I wish to return. High in the heavens shines the afternoon sun. My heart is filled with yearning. And thus wrote Zhou Wanyang, a scholar official who lived in 12th century China. Swallows sing at the window. They tell of the daybreak. Home is far away. When can I go back? Wumen is my hometown, and I've resided in Chang'an too long. Sentiment for home has become something of a cliché in Chinese poetry. Compared with Westerners, the Chinese notably lack wanderlust. Distances are great and communications difficult. Scholar officials such as Zhou are sent elsewhere for administrative duties, and there they pine for home. Pining for home can make people melancholic and even seriously ill. In 1688, Johannes Hofer of Mulhouse sought to address the cause before an academic audience. He was defending his dissertation, but the dissertation couldn't be about something so vulgar as heimweh, homesickness. So he coined a word with the Greek roots, nostalgia. The new word made depression respectable, a disease that could be treated. But once so recognized, it aroused fear. People were reluctant to stay away from home for long. They learned that English sailors pressed into service and Swiss soldiers stationed in foreign countries were especially susceptible. In the early part of the 18th century, a common explanation of why Swiss soldiers so readily fell ill was that they missed the thick milk from their own valley and that they also missed their mother's loving care. But these explanations seem to denigrate the manly character of the Swiss soldiers. So a more scientific hypothesis was offered, namely that when the Swiss left their mountain home to serve in the lowlands, their blood vessels were compressed by the denser air, thus making them lethargic and sad. Sentimentality for home might be expected of old Europe. In America, the land of immigrants and of mobility, it should be less in evidence. Yet, one of the most trickly expressions of the love of home, an expression that still adorns Hallmark cards, are lines composed by the American songwriter J.H. Payne in 1822, Home, Sweet Home. William Arms Fisher's Going Home is another example. It was written in 1922 and set to the music of the Dvorak's New York Symphony. You all know that, going home, going home, I am going home. Language articulates and enhances our beliefs. Certain grammatical constructions show the profound appeal of home place and community, by comparison with which elsewhere is distant and insignificant. And yet, under certain conditions, elsewhere too can be a lure. The constructions I have in mind are the personal pronouns, the we, you, she, and they, the spatial demonstratives, this, that, and those, the adverbs of location, here, there, and yonder, and the adverbs of time, now, then. All these constructions privilege the close at hand. In human relationships, we or us matter most. Ortega y Gasset notes even a subtle difference between North Portuguese, New French, and Nosotros Spanish. whereas the Portuguese and French words express merely the closeness of shared living, the Spanish word, which is not just we, but we others, nosotros, implies a more intimate human bond, one cemented by an awareness of strangers. Beyond the charmed circle of we is another you who matter less, and still farther out, mattering still less, is the third person, he, she, they. Personal pronouns run parallel with spatial demonstratives. The two might even have a common origin. Roland Barthes says that if in conversation we hear a man refer to his friend as he rather than as Paul, we will know that their relationship has cooled. This matters, that and those progressively less so. When Bertrand Russell was asked what he and his friends did with their time, he sadly replied, "We did this and that, but alas, mostly that." That can only be inconsequential, and as for those, they are beyond the pale. How does one arouse fervor for one's homeland? One uses repeatedly this. Shakespeare shows how this can be done in the following well-known lines from Richard II. "This happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in a silver sea, which serves it in the office of a wall." Or as a moat defensive to a house against the envy of less happier bands, lands. "This blessed earth, this realm." Each this swells further the patriot sense of belongingness and pride. Adverbs of location and of time have become a little more ambivalent under the influence of Romanticism, at least in English usage. "Here and now are still privileged. Here is where I am, or where we are. There is where you are, and yonder is where they are. Here is now, there is then, and then is either the future or the past. Yonder is far away, and far away is the unknown and scary." Zulu for far away is decidedly negative. It is there where someone cries out, "Oh, mother, I'm lost." But in the modern Western world, far away connotes something magically appealing. Far away and long ago is how a fairy tale begins. Then connotes the distant, and the distant can be the past, as in things were better then, or the future, as in sit down, then the show will begin. But with sufficient distance, then becomes far away and timeless, an utopian place where no one ages and no one dies. Ponce de Leon in 1512 searched for the fabled Fountain of Youth in Florida. James Hilton, in his novel The Lost Horizon, placed the land of eternal youth in remote Tibet. But every holiday resort makes a claim to being outside of time and its burdens, the idyllic place where no one needs to wear a watch. A feature of modern life is the range of technical means that link us instantly to distant parts of the world. We can always be elsewhere, and although the elsewhere may not be appealing and may even be repellent, it is nonetheless able to seduce our imagination and hold it captive. Suppose I'm a cab driver tooling down a winding road in the Colorado mountains. The road and the mountains are his environment. He is bodily there, and his mind, I assume, is on the road. But no, his radio is on, and he's cheering the Cincinnati Reds. Or again, suppose I see a man in an armchair reading a newspaper. I take that room to be his place. He's often there. But is he? Bodily, yes. But his eyes are glued to headlines on the front page, and his mind is where his son is, a soldier in Afghanistan. Reading can conjure up a reality so vivid as to overshadow the one we are in. An extreme example is the story told about soldiers in the First World War who, in mud-filled trenches and with bullets whistling overhead, read Tolstoy's War and Peace to get war's full flavor. Books and electronic media can take us elsewhere, but only in imagination. When we fall in love, we may actually even gladly abandon home for elsewhere. What need of home when all the comfort and nurture we require, as well as beauty and ecstasy, are provided by the beloved? In romances, lovers leap over the wall to start a new life. My question now is, can one also fall in love with a geographical place, be swept off one's feet by a view, a landscape? The answer is yes. Something like this happened to Hugo Williams, a young man of 21, who drifted from country to country, continent to continent, and ended up in a small boat at the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. The men in the boat were friendly. They passed around a cigarette containing hashish. Williams made himself popular by puffing at it. He enjoyed the warm night, the bubbling, luminous floats of the fisher boats, the shooting stars between the masts, the laughs in a strange language. He then noticed for the first time how far he was getting from home. Rather than feel homesick, he experienced almost total physical pleasure at the thought. I had a similar experience at the same age. A few friends and I arrived at the edge of Death Valley, California at night in a howling, howling dust storm. We couldn't fight the wind and set up tents, so we slept in our sleeping bags. I woke up early in the morning, rubbed my eyes, and was confronted by Death Valley in all its stark, sterile beauty. I felt instant identification with it. Would I have known who I really am if I had never left the humid East? How limiting home can seem in retrospect. It fed and clothed me. It gave me habits and customs. But it held no mirror to the psycho-spiritual kernel of my being. Wherever we are, our senses immediately bind us to it. Think and we're out of our senses, detached and elsewhere. Significantly, a common image of the wise man or seer is one who is blind or can barely see. And the common image of the thinker, intellectual or nerd, is one whose eyesight is poor and has to wear glasses. A sapiente or thinker has no need of home and may indeed believe that homelessness, not being bound to the values and beliefs of a particular place is a requirement of thinking. Aristotle was apparently the first to recognize this. In an early work, the Protopticus, he argued that the philosopher should be homeless. This nowhere should love homelessness, this nowhere, as though it were a country. Who were the intellectuals in Greece's golden age? Plato might be the last to have real roots in society and place. His successors seem to have lived beside society rather than in it. Aristotle, Theophrastus, Zeno, Cleanthes, and Chrysippus were all of them foreigners. Only Epicurus was of Athenian stock, though by birth a colonial. Thinking makes us an exile, which is why thinking, a long process that separates one from place and community, is widely discouraged. As for exile, in the sense of physical expulsion, it was and is considered a calamity. God, after all, deemed it an appropriate punishment for Adam and Eve when they yielded to temptation. Had they successfully resisted, they would have remained in Eden, the perfect home. They would have retained a childlike innocence and lived in ignorance of the height, depths, and ambiguities of human life. They would have forfeited opportunities for not only intellectual, but also spiritual, moral growth. History provides instances of people forced into exile and suffering deeply from it. And yet the same people might gain certain spiritual benefits from the displacement, at least in the long run. Consider the Jews. Exiled by the Babylonians, they were forced to rub along with other peoples and confront their creeds, with the result that the Jews were able to transcend the narrower tenets of their own religion. In the second, Isaiah is enunciated the pure principle of monotheism as a world cause, freed from the specifically Palestinian limitations of the cult of Yahweh. Uprooting was able to bring to fruition universalist ideas that existed only in germinal form in the older prophets. In Europe, Jews lived for centuries in ghettos surrounded by other peoples and cultures. They were able to protect their identity by complicated rituals and taboos, and by never ceasing to dream of their lost homeland. In the 19th century, as the ghetto walls began to crumble, Jews participated increasingly in European society and culture, such that by the early 20th century, they could be said to have flooded Europe's intellectual and spiritual space. Some of them, like Marx, Freud, and Einstein, to quote Leszek Kolakowski, were to become real world conquerors. Thousands found their places in the elite of all realms of civilization, the sciences, arts, humanities, and politics. To put this another way, if Jews of the diaspora came to feel at home in foreign lands, it wasn't so much because they wholly immersed themselves in Gentile society and culture, as because they added to them a high cosmopolitan polish of their own making. In 1948, the state of Israel was created. At last, the Jews had their own officially recognized homeland. 60 years after its founding, Israel can boast of prosperity and a high level of cultural and scientific achievement. On the other hand, it has become an occupying military power, surrounded by hostile neighbors, and the nation somewhat unsure of its identity. This being the case, will Israel be fertile ground for the emergence of thinkers of the scope and depth of Marx, Freud, and Einstein? Will the Jewish people, in other words, have found a homeland, but in the process crippled their universalist spirit? Religion is not about making a home on earth. That's geography. Yet so much that come under the heading religion is precisely about homemaking, about how to survive and live well in this life. Consider the American Indian corn dance and the Tibetan prayer wheel. Both are said to be religious ceremonies. Yet, what is the real purpose of the corn dance other than that the earth yield more corn for humans? And the purpose of the Tibetan prayer wheel other than that the wind can effortlessly turn the wheel on which prayers are attached to ward off evil and promote human well-being? Not all placemaking is directed at survival. A place should also satisfy human emotional needs and aesthetic longings. Sacred places, both natural and built, do that well. On the other hand, even secular artworks and ceremonials can generate beauty and awe. So what is left that is true, that truly distinguishes the sacred from the secular? The moral? But sacred places are hardly more moral or more serene than our secular ones. In fact, the opposite may be true. All too often, sacred places are places of violence. Historically, animal sacrifice and in earlier times, human sacrifice were conducted at the doorsteps of temples and shrines. And not only historically, but in our own time, the more sacred the place, the more it is likely to spill blood. Due to conflict between peoples of rival faiths. Buddhism and Christianity, in their most exalted formulations, are not about homemaking. They are otherworldly and hence cannot be subsumed under geography. Home is elsewhere may well be their motto. In Buddhist legend, Siddhartha Gautama, later known as the Buddha, was a prince whose life began where most human beings would want to end, at the perfect home, one that had the best of material goods and the best of human company. Yet Siddhartha thought that not even the perfect home could protect him from sickness, old age, and death. So he left it in search of enlightenment, and was to find it not in a famous temple or shrine, but under a peepal tree. He then wandered over the Gangetic plain, preaching to followers irrespective of their caste or religion. Enlightenment, as the Buddha saw it, required the death of desire that was the cause of greed, lust, hatred, and ignorance, which in turn led to suffering and death. To be truly enlightened is to enter nirvana, and nirvana, being placeless, negates all that we understand as geography. Christianity has its roots in Judaism and shares with it a profound attachment to homeland and community. In Jesus' ministry, more than once he showed his partiality to the house of Israel and to them alone. But soon his message shifted to the universalism that transcended place, community, and culture. To the Samaritan woman who said that her folks worshipped in the mountain, whereas Jews worshipped in Jerusalem's temple, Jesus' response was that the real worshippers worshipped in neither, but rather in spirit and in truth. At the Transfiguration, Jesus' disciples were so impressed that they wanted to build a monument in his honor. If it had been built, a sacred place for Christians would have been created. But Jesus would have none of it. Often on the road, Jesus noted that whereas foxes had holes and birds had nests, he had no place to rest his head. Good Roman families were centered on the home. To them, what was especially objectionable about Christians was that they lacked proper respect for home and hearth. They had no household shrines at which to worship ancestors and gods. They were deficient in family values. The Roman patriarch's word for the Christian was pilgrim, peregrinus, by which he meant a bird of passage, a wayfarer, a foreigner, none of which was complimentary. The early Christians, however, turned the meaning around. They took pride in being strangers and pilgrims on the earth, for their true home was elsewhere. Home is a Western, in the Western world, did not acquire its present load of sentiment until well into the 19th century. In the past, it was a shelter, or often a setting for social display. Only with the rise of the prosperous middle class in the last two centuries did home become an enclosed space of comfort and nurture, of dreams and memories, of padded couches and thick carpets, of the boudoir in which to pout and the library in which to think. Home has become so thickly layered with sentiment that to leave it is to abandon an important part of oneself. The result is homesickness. One yearns to return, but this is not possible because home and self have both changed. One returns not to the past, but to a reconstituted, sepia-tinted image. There may, however, be another sense to returning home, though the word going home would be more accurate. It is the preternatural feeling that one is a mere resident alien on earth, that one's true home is elsewhere. The source of that feeling in the West is historically Christianity. Nowhere is Christianity's rapid decline in our time more manifest than the fading belief in our status as sojourners, and simultaneously the rise in our commitment to this world and home. The commitment occurs at two levels. At one level are the Christian fundamentalists, who, for all their preaching of the blessings of heaven, propagate the lure of the materialist good life here on earth, tokens of which are the well-appointed family house and the mega church. At another level are the well-educated, secular liberals whose good works consist in keeping the earth green and forever habitable, a permanent home for humans and their fellow creatures. What else, they might say, is there to strive for? Thank you.
Thank you for those profound and radical thoughts. I'm deeply moved. I appreciate very much your celebration of the tug of the envisaged elsewhere. And then also your idea that home can be a prison in which feelings might stew in a confined space and identities might become uncertain. So given that situation, what would you teach us about those who are desperate to return, such as people who have been displaced from New Orleans, who are still living around the country and are deeply moved to return, or Palestinians, or Tibetans, or people who for whom nostalgia probably wouldn't satisfy the situation. What is your advice on that score?
Yes. One of my favorite writers is this French woman, Simone Weil. She wrote, she published very little, but she did write something for De Gaulle as a document for a liberated France called The Need for Roots. And people reading it liked it very much because it feeds in to a sentiment we all share, that we need to feel connected. If rooted is not quite the word you want, but we need to be rooted or connected. So she seemed to be saying something that people can grasp. But actually, she urged the need for roots, and she condemned wars and of that kind because it uproots people. It makes people into refugees. They are displaced from home. And that she considered a tragedy. But why such a tragedy from her viewpoint? Because it deprives people of the opportunity to uproot themselves. That's what you want. If you're uprooted, you know, you can't do it on your own, which is what she really is after.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.